Hey guys, if you want updates on our latest episodes, then be sure to subscribe to the Film Colossus podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Also, if you'd like to support the show and hear episodes ad-free, then subscribe to our Patreon page at patreon.com/filmcolossus.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
My name is Chris Lambert.
And my name is Travis Bean. And on today's episode, we pick apart what is considered one of the most enigmatic movies of all time, Mulholland Drive. Our discussion breaks this classic film down into simple terms, revealing the humanistic underbelly of David Lynch's cautionary tale about Hollywood and fantasy.
What's an appropriate... Oh, I know what an appropriate beginning is.
Okay, this is part of the beginning, though.
This is part of the I know that. Okay. I know that. So this is the best embodiment of the movie. Ready?
Okay.
Silencio.
I don't think that much time passes before she says silencio.
Oh, well, get out your stopwatch, buddy, because
and there's a glowing. A glowing ringing going on, like there's ambiance. It's not just dead silence.
No, but audio-wise.
All right.
I know.
I'll insert some sounds. How about that?
Maybe I should have recorded myself doing an intro before and then played the recording of me doing an intro as the intro.
Maybe. Or you should have came out and been like, "No, I banda."
That would have been better. Yeah, if I had just got out the screenplay and read his lines.
Yeah, and then you think there's two guys sitting in chairs doing a podcast, but there aren't. It's a recording.
Right?
Which is kind of true.
It's true. You're not listening to this live.
Yeah, you're not looking at me right now, are you?
That would be terrifying.
Yeah. Please let me know if you are. Because I want to know how you're doing it.
All right. Mulholland Drive. This was your pick.
Yep.
Are you satisfied with your pick?
Yeah, it was all right. This movie's okay.
Yeah. Just up there for you. A little up there
Maybe
for you.
Maybe tries a little bit too hard sometimes. But, you know, I give it a pass for its effort.
If anybody doesn't know, this is one of Travis's favorite movies of all time.
Absolutely. This is how I fell in love with David Lynch. I don't even know when I would have first seen it. I imagine it was definitely part of my like okay, I'm getting into movies, like what movies do I need to watch? Like it was part of those stages probably within the first 3 or 4 years I was watching movies. And my guess is this came on the latter end of that, when I had finally started my old blog, Cinema Beans, it's still up. You can still go read my shitty reviews that I wrote way back when. And I remember writing about Mulholland Drive and like trying to make sense of it. And like, it was this combination of I really liked it for its weirdness, but like, think maybe the message doesn't hit hard enough, or like I'm wondering like why people love it so much. And ever since then, it's just been a slow, steady understanding of both the movie and Lynch as a filmmaker. And as I've absorbed his output and understood his movies, I get, at least how I understand them, because he famously doesn't want anyone to understand his movies almost. He like never answers questions about the deeper meaning of his movie, so it's like purely up to interpretation. But I guess what I've learned over the years is like I think his movies are a lot more simple than meets the eye. Like a lot of people are really obsessed with the details in a David Lynch movie, And I have found that the movies are just much easier to take in and understand if I purely look at them from an emotional standpoint and think about the characters and what they're going through, and concern myself less with like plot details and more of like seeing the human qualities of what's happening on screen. I've just found myself really endeared to these movies over the year, and Mulholland Drive has just stood above the rest in that way. Like Inland Empire, for instance, Chris, a movie I know you love. it's a movie like I recognize all the things it does well, but I can't love it like I love Mulholland Drive. Mulholland Drive just does something so heavy and honest with its main character in a way that it's just become an important part of my life in that way over the years. Like I see myself in the movie in a lot of ways. Like I look past the weirdness and just see like what this person's going through. I don't know how many times I've seen it at this point, probably at least 10. I saw it once in a theater, which was really cool. And nice. Back when they were doing the 4K restoration at first. And yeah, it's just a movie that's been a constant in my life ever since. And I've loved it more and more every time I watch it, including today for this podcast.
I first saw it, I had gone to Sundance in 2013. It was my first time going to Sundance, and my friend Laura came with me, and she's from Australia, and I ended up flying back to Australia and crashing with her at her parents' house for like 3 weeks.
Oh, nice.
And
I feel like I don't remember this because I was with you then.
It was the year before we went. I went for the first time in 2014.
Got it.
So 2013, yeah, I just went to Sundance, flew back to Australia, and I'd lived in Australia. I'd studied abroad there, and after college moved back there for a year. So it was kind of like a return after a couple years and getting to catch up with some people and see some friends. And it was just after my mom had passed, so there was like a lot of decompressing that was going on. And Laura and I talk about movies all the time, and she brought up Mulholland Drive, and I was like, no, I've never seen it. She's like, Chris, you've never seen, I can't do her Australian accent, but you've never seen Mulholland Drive. You've never seen Mulholland Drive, and made this like big deal about me not seeing Mulholland Drive. So we watched it on like a little dumb TV in her room.
Yeah.
And she's like in her bed. I'm on the air mattress on the ground, and we're just watching like
this movie.
A
2.5 hour movie.
Yeah. And I was captivated the whole time.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. But I was just like, wow, this is not an ideal way to view this movie, but wow. And it ended, and we spent like hours talking about it, which was fun. And then I think it was because at the time I knew you loved Magnolia, but I think it was shortly after that. In that 2013-2014 period, that Mulholland Drive, like for a time, rose up to your like top movie ever.
Yeah, it's always been one of those movies for me. You know, like there are five movies. I would say there are probably like, I don't know why I'm getting so specific. But when I look at my rankings, like there really are seven movies that feel like essential pieces of my puzzle, and like this is definitely one of them.
And so I remember having some talks with you about it, and it was very cool to have that conversation because the insight you were providing into it and just like the idea of like the Hollywood dream and how he explores it. And that's something over the last few years with our site and explaining movies, how we do, there's so many movies about like the Hollywood dream.
Totally. This and topic, it exactly.
Not being what you thought it would. And it's not like this started. It was Sunset Boulevard was kind of one of the kickoff points for that, right? Iconic, or like a very seminal movie for that. But there have been so many over the years that are just like that exact topic, but handled in different styles and ways. La La Land is the same exact thing. Babylon is actually the same exact thing. Like Damien Chazelle made the same movie, but just went about it in different ways. So Mulholland Drive, as I've discovered more of that genre, has continued to be one that I'm just like, couldn't they just all be Mulholland Drive?
Yeah, right.
And terms of how they go about it. So I had fond memories of it. This was only my second time watching it.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I remember when you wrote the movie guide for it or the mm-hmm. explanation for it. Like, I think that was at a time where we were like tag teaming a little bit more, like mm-hmm. doing some like check-ins with each other about it. So I remember going back and watching like the last 20 minutes again.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually had forgotten a lot of it. So
you
there were entire like everything else.
Oh,
like,
oh yeah.
There were whole stretches. Because from my mind, like most of the movie was like the two women.
Right.
It was Betty and Rita. For the most part, and it's like, oh no, for a lot of the movie is like not them whatsoever. I forgot that Justin Theroux had such a big part uh-huh. in it, and he had like a whole subplot that had all these things.
A very interesting and weird subplot.
Yeah, which still ties back to the Hollywood dream being like shitty, and you get some of the underworld elements. That was what was jumping out to me too, was, you know, people
the Kate will Beckinsale react movie? To
oh sorry like no but what a movie.
I didn't see any vampires for the record, but keep going.
What about the vampire werewolf hybrid?
The lichen vampire hybrid, of course.
Yeah of course, of
don't
course.
They have a name for that in the movies.
Yeah, isn't that the second one, Underworld yeah. Evolution?
It's always part of the movies, but you finally see one, I think, in Evolution.
Because I think the first one is just you have the vampires and you have the lichen, but in the second one, there's the guy
yeah.
who is both vampire and lichen.
Exactly, and it's very interesting.
But
I actually like that a lot. But, okay, move on.
Of course you do. The underworld element of Hollywood, which in the third hour of Babylon, I feel like it was something that people in the third hour of Babylon were like, why do we have this Tobey Maguire stuff? Why do they go into like a weird nightclub?
I forgot and that Maguire was in that movie.
Is that supposed to get at the seedy aspect of Hollywood that's part of the history of Hollywood, that it's not just like lights, camera, see it, lights, camera, action.
Yeah.
There's actually been like mob elements, these ugly elements. It's not just what you see on the surface, but there's some deeper, uglier things.
Hmm.
And that's kind of what you're getting from Justin Theroux's arc here, is that filmmaking isn't just the director has a vision and he in the studio might butt heads. Like, you do have some of the uglier like components that come into cinema that get people
business.
Some roles that they shouldn't have. Yeah, the business is maybe a lot more mobstery than we may think. And you could take that literally as that there is this like seedy underworld that has an influence on film, but you could also just view it as like Lynch talking about the studios as if they're like mafia people.
Yeah.
And see it as a little more symbolic. But I think it still gets at a relevant idea to the movie. So I was pretty surprised by how much I had forgotten about it.
I mean, the first... when you come out of the dream and you're just with Diane, that's about 30 minutes of the movie?
Yeah.
So you watched 2 hours of something that didn't happen.
Yeah, it was just impressionism or her wishes of how things could have gone. Which,
it's
what an elaborate
of things.
Yeah, what an elaborate fantasy.
I think was my biggest takeaway from this viewing was it, and why I think this movie really does reward repeat viewings. Like, it did make me think of what you were saying about The Hateful Eight and how, like, once you know what the twist is in The Hateful Eight, it doesn't add anything necessarily, and it doesn't enrich the viewing experience on repeat watchings, because like it doesn't necessarily add tension to anything. Whereas in Mulholland Drive, it really builds the tension that you know none of this is real, and you're starting to dig into why Diane is manipulating certain people or certain situations in a certain way. And I just think the more and more times I watch this movie, the more insight I get into her mind and how she is and how much she bought into the Hollywood dream, or into just the bigger dream of like what her life could have been. I just find that like for instance, you know, like she's trying out for a movie in her dream, and it starts with her doing lines with Rita, and they're doing it, and she's, her acting's like bad and theatrical, and they laugh at how silly the scene is, which is honestly like one of my favorite parts of the movie. Like such a such just like an honest moment where you just like stop and laugh like, this is fucking stupid. But then like, so you have that base layer, and then you go into the actual audition, and suddenly she's doing really well, and it feels really real and honest, except it's not real. Like, even in this dream fantasy, this moment isn't real. It's just an audition. It's just pretend. And then I feel like the energy of that scene is then mimicked when she finally kisses Rita, and they have this moment where they connect, and it feels so real, just like that scene, except this time it's real. Like, she's actually kissing her, except it's not real. It's still the dream. Like, it, the layers keep building and keep showing just how far her delusion has gone. And, like, it isn't necessarily just a Hollywood dream. There's this documentary I've always wanted to watch. I'll probably watch it soon because I've been thinking about it nonstop. But I think it's called Lynch Oz or something like that. And it's just about David Lynch's obsession with The Wizard of Oz. And it's this movie he always talks about, and it's such a good insight into his filmography, I think, because his movies are constantly about people's perception of reality and the reality they'd like to live in. Almost every one of his movies has done this to an almost comical degree. But then Mulholland Drive and Inland Empire took it a step further into the actual realm of movies, making the movie you're watching very meta. It was kind of the culmination of his exploration of this topic. But that's what I really love about Mulholland Drive, is that thinking about it in terms of The Wizard of Oz, and like especially thinking about it in terms of all the movies you mentioned and how they feel kind of flat compared to something like Mulholland Drive, is because Mulholland Drive just isn't about a Hollywood dream. It's about somebody's detachment from the world. It's more than just the Hollywood dream that was sold to her. It was a dream that was sold to her, like a life she could live, an ideal life, and she's not achieving it. And anybody can relate to that, like how difficult that is to be realizing, like, I'm not living the life I thought I was going to be living, and how hard that is to deal with. And so those layers of, you know, the acting and like her trying to like create this life that isn't real all throughout the first 4/5 of the movie, like, that's such a bold and incredible move that, as I say, like, I've just realized over time, like, it is about the Hollywood dream, but, like, it's so much more than that. Like, it's so incredible how much deeper it goes.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season 2 of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Yeah, because as Hollywoodized as it is, as you're saying, it's just about somebody with a dream and getting at the crushing aspects of it. It's almost like the ethereal aspect of the film that makes it confusing for people and hard to penetrate also is what gives it a little more universality than what you get from Babylon, where Babylon's so specific. And La La Land transcends just a little bit because it's so grounded in the romance aspect that the movie feels more universal because so many people relate to having like a crush on somebody or having this like almost relationship that never came to pass, and having that like what could have been. So because it defamiliarizes the Hollywood dream and the complications of the Hollywood dream through a more universal romance story, mm-hmm. that's made that movie so incredibly popular. But Mulholland Drive has this kind of like gut punch aspect that I think can surprise a lot of people, because even if they didn't understand all the specifics about what was happening and why it was happening, you get the weight of the contrast between how she thought her life could go and the vision that she had for her life and what she hoped for her life versus what her life actually is. And some of the like whiplash that you get from trying to catch up with the revelation of that, like, who is it? She's actually Diane. This is her life. She's kind of angry and overwhelmed and overworked and bitter, and geez, kind of embodies the feeling that we all have when it comes to thinking about, we're just, you know, young and bright eyed in like high school with dreams of tomorrow, and now we're mid 30s or yeah. older or late 20s, and like, where's the time gone? How did I get here? Didn't I have these big dreams? And even if you're like satisfied, you still think back to maybe some of the dreams where you hoped you would be or could be. I think most people feel behind the curve, even if they feel like they're in a good spot. And the movie captures all of that so well, and in such a like a visceral way rather than a narrative told to you way.
Yeah, right.
That it's a very powerful experience, and I think one that benefits from the repeat viewings. And as people, you know, succeed in life or feel more behind the curve in life, it's one that they can come back to and either view with relief or with even more of a sense of existential dread.
Yeah. It's a great movie too for repeat viewings, just in terms of like, if you're a sleuth viewer, you know, like I wouldn't even consider myself one of those kinds of people. I'm more just looking at like characters and like a story told well. But I, because I've seen Mulholland Drive so many times, and because I know all the things people are obsessed with, I have become a little obsessed with like knowing all the little details. Obviously, I've written about it in the explanation, which, by the way, is maybe the only explanation, like not the only, but the one I cared most about, like being number one on Google. I really want that to happen. And I'm like sometimes theorizing like, you know, what ways can I do? Like what backlinks can I create? Anyway, go read it. There are a few things that like I've started to notice that are really cool. I guess famously, we should note that David Lynch gave out 10 clues to unlocking the movie, which was like a weird moment for him because he never does stuff like that. But I guess he was really pressed to do it because people were so confused by his movie back when it came out, which is still funny to me to this day. Like, I know some of it's confusing and there are a lot of details to examine, but like, it's not exactly confusing once you just realize that everything's a dream and then suddenly you're not in the dream. But anyway, he gave all these clues, and some of the clues are insightful to how you could start to like theorize a few things that are happening. Like he tells you to pay attention to the telephone in Diane's room. And I think that's cool because in the dream that Diane's having, she imagines the Castiglione, what are their names? Something like that. The mob boss brothers, when they are calling each other and like, you know, saying like, you need to kill the girl. The last call is to Diane's phone, which is really weird. And then, and in my mind, that is just like, it feels like the dream kind of trying to reach through to Diane in real life, or like Diane knows deep down that none of this is real and none of this is fulfilling because you're chasing something that isn't part of your life. So you need to like, you need to take better care of yourself. You need to move on and all that. Like she knows that deep down and is trying to contact herself through the phone or something like that. And I think that all gets at the end of the movie, or at the end of the dream sequence, when she's in the theater and she's watching the show and she's realizing that none of it's happening, and she's starting to convulse and she finds the blue key that's going to take her back. There's just this, there's a sense that the dream is trying to like shake her awake and tell her to like, you know, wake up, like see what life is really like. It's just so cool that all these little things lend insight into those potential avenues. And none of it's just plot. That's what I like about it. It's not just like know the plot better and know the secrets better. Like, it's actually insight into her character and what she's going through and how destructive the situation has become and all that. I just love that the details all seem humanistic to me in that way.
Humanistic is a good word for it, because there is such an emotional quality to everything that's happening. And yeah, that tension of the dream trying to end and her not wanting it to end, because she doesn't want to face the reality of what she did and what the blue key actually represents. But that guilty conscious aspect of it, or the inability to hold on to the dream, because reality is just constantly there,
yeah,
becomes too much. It's really, and especially like the idea that the guilt is embodied by or personified by, what do they call the parking lot man?
The monster behind the dumpster, I think.
Yeah, the dumpster monster. Yeah. Do we have like a name for the dumpster monster?
I think that is the credit. I've seen something about this before, about what this, it's actually a woman who plays it, but I believe the character's name is the man behind the dumpster, but a woman plays it. So I've heard monster, I've heard man behind the dumpster, something like that.
On Wikipedia, it's just bum.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Bonnie Ahrens, who actually also plays the nun. In The Nun and The Nun 2.
No shit.
And The Conjuring.
Oh, she's great.
And Annabelle.
Man, and she's in Drag Me to Hell. Oh, man, I'm going to watch this woman's discography. Wow, did Mulholland Drive, Princess Diaries, and Shallow Hal in the same year.
What a...
It's crazy.
What a crazy-ass year.
Yeah, and but also a craziest year for her life.
The best movie of those three is Shallow Hal, of course.
Of course, yeah. That's a Farrelly Brothers movie, so don't shit on it.
I hate that movie so much.
Oh, really? Okay. I mean, I haven't seen it in a while.
I just remember it being on HBO back in the day, and it kept being on before things that I'd want to watch, so I'd keep catching portions of it. And being like, this is just such an insane movie. Like, an insane movie. The ending is just outrageous.
Yeah, I'd have to watch it again, like I said, but I feel like I've just always had a soft spot for Jack Black, maybe because of High Fidelity, which is such an important movie in my life. But I've always really liked him, and my family, actually, we all dressed up as Jack Black characters for Halloween. So I don't know. I'm a fan of Shallow Hal.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're a Jack Black man.
Yeah, look at me. Well, don't, if you are black. Looking at me, by the way, please let me know how you're doing it.
So the bum, nun, the nun bum, is so terrifying, but you could also see like that also being this embodiment of guilt or reality or the weights of everything that she's faced, and having that component, especially like, I love the end and how surreal it gets with the old people. Love coming it. Into the house. Like the whole last 30 minutes is so okay. My reaction this time was I found the first hour and a half maybe a little less compelling than I had historically. It had some like good shots, some funny moments. It actually in a lot of ways felt more like a blueprint for how a lot of modern films and like TV are. It felt almost like its DNA had has like spread out into a lot of very modern things, especially we've been catching up on the show Fargo, which I kind of hate, but I feel like Fargo is in some ways doing like a weird, like poor man's version of both like Coen Brothers and Mulholland Drive, not in terms of like plots, but just in terms of like some of the style and the humor. Like I forgot how funny Mulholland Drive was. Like, it was cracking me up at so many scenes. But then the really like high points of the film, like Betty's audition, is just such a crazy scene. It's like such an amazing. Yeah, like I love that scene so much. And then the assassin trying to get the little black book is also just like a hilarious, hilarious sequence.
That's classic Lynch humor.
Yeah, it's just like each thing going wrong when he did like an initial good job in quotes. So there's a lot of like very fascinating things, but the last 30 minutes when you get the change in Naomi Watts's character and being, it's so incredible to me. Like the job she does in this movie is such like a masterwork of acting.
Yeah.
I'm blown away by it every single time. This was also one of her first American films, wasn't
it? Was it not her first one?
It was her first one, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah. It's nuts.
I still feel like we have it. What's her best work?
Mulholland Drive.
That's fair. I love her in King Kong too.
Well, she's in The Ring.
Which
21 Grams, that's like heavy acting.
I haven't seen 21 Grams.
I heard Huckabee's, she has a little bit of life. Like she's done some good. Oh yeah, King Kong, of course.
Yeah, I love her in King Kong.
Yeah, great stuff.
I love King Kong.
She's good in Eastern Promises as well. She's kind of like a broken person in that.
Yeah, I remember that. It's just, she's so, that twist from being so bubbly and bright-eyed to so crushed and put upon and worn is awesome. But when we finally get to the little old people like chasing her through as kind of this embodiment of the hopes and potential and like how much they were welcoming her to Hollywood and wishing her the best of luck and like rooting for her. It's like you can almost see them as embodying all of the potential that she felt for the place. And they're chasing her right into the scary dumpster bum.
Yeah.
Who is at like all the guilt and pain and like dirty, just, like the worst parts of everything that have happened and like drives her to death. It's such a great like Freudian, who is Freud's other guy.
I always forget that did guy.
The person that follows you, who he tutored, trained.
Guy who follows
who did
me?
The archetypes. Yeah, looking at you through the window.
I was going to say, are there people outside my home?
When you have somebody that you train in your stead, apprentice. It was his apprentice.
Wait, who follows me? I need to know the answer to this question.
But he did Twitter? The psychological. He did the Jungian, Carl Jung.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah. He does follow me.
That's. I just meant like the idea of somebody that follows like in your footsteps after you finish something, not like you literally.
I deeply misread what you were saying. Keep going.
Yeah. I thought you were doing a bit. And then I was like.
Well,
no. Yeah,
I thought you were doing a bit.
An apprentice. That's what I meant.
Got it.
The apprentice who follows in your footsteps. Carl Jung did the Jungian archetypes.
Got him.
So it feels very like Freudian, Jungian, and having these figures like chase her down, and then having the this embodiment of the worst parts of her. It's so good. It's like such a climactic ending to me.
Yeah, I've written about the ending and feel like I understand it pretty well, but I felt like I felt the heaviness of it so much more this time, and how, yeah, the old people kind of chase her through their home. Actually, in that moment, when the old people are crawling under the door, which is just one of the best moments in this movie. These little old, tiny old people cackling and like their tiny little voices, like, like, so good. But as they're crawling in, there are lights flashing all around, and there's a knock at Diane's door. And I had never thought about this before, and I wondered if you had thought this, that the police are outside her home in that moment. And that they're like coming to get her, and she kind of has this moment of like, she's, you know, she's feeling guilty for what she did, but she's also like gonna go to jail for it, so she just kills herself.
Yeah, I mean, her ex did mention the detective wanted to see her.
Oh.
So the police being outside the door, or the detective at least being outside the door and knocking, does feel like that sense of like coming due.
Yeah.
Like you're about to get caught, and then she ends up becoming the woman in the bed that they found in her dream.
Yeah. But it really adds to the intensity of the moment, because like there are just like lights kind of flickering before that. But then once the old people grow to normal size and are chasing around the hall and she's screaming, like the lights are flashing like crazy, and it becomes very surreal and detached. And then it's cool because you could see the scene kind of slowly dipping further and further away from like who Diane was. The ending basically becomes like a eulogy for her, and she goes to the bed and shoots herself, and the smoke rises up, like all of a sudden, yeah, we're like being lifted into like somewhere else, and the first place we go is to the man behind the dumpster who is holding the blue box, and we kind of go into him, and that, which goes into a shot of just their Diane, I guess at this point it's Betty and Rita, because suddenly we're seeing Rita with the blonde hair, so we know we're looking at the dream versions of them. And it's just these shots of them all lit up with LA in the background. It's almost like they're ghosts resting there, and like, but they're still smiling, which to me, like, that's how I'm reading the ending now, is the end kind of dips further and further away from reality slowly. So like, starts with the old people, then goes to the man who like brings you into the dream world, who lets you in and out, he's bringing you back in, and then we're seeing these two women and remembering them in a way, and looking at them and saying like, oh, we lost these people. But it's cool because it's not just that, it becomes suddenly a eulogy for Betty, or it becomes like maybe more of what it is Diane is gone, and like all that's left is this version of her that she wished she could be. In a way, it becomes a eulogy for like the dream itself, and like all of the promise it represented but was never, yeah, going to give you. It's becomes a visualization of the realization of it's all a lie, that you can't just depend on like this dream that's been sold to you. You have to build a life, like you have to find your own fulfillment and all that. Ending finally with the woman who's in the theater, and she says silencio, and like literally end, like that's it, no more needs to be said about this, like it's done. I just think it's hard to put into words. I mean, you hear me struggling to put in the words here, and I've seen it a million times and explained it on the site, but it's the way the ending navigates that situation and reflects on Diane's life and what it had become. It's visually, I just think it's so incredible they pulled that off.
Yeah, I really love, I think what you're getting at, it becomes very clear in including the shot of Los Angeles,
mm-hmm,
under the like ethereal ghostly image of Betty and Rita, because that seems to imply that the positivity or the hope that she had for this life, everything that life could have been, was tied to the city of Los Angeles and the promise that Los Angeles offers.
Mm.
It wasn't just Betty's dream. It's the dream of, or Diane's dream of what her life could have been. It's this dream that the city itself promises people. And it's a dream that the city itself kind of destroys and takes away. So that's very like a powerful statement to make, and does have that eulogy aspect of that weight of what could have been, and really leaving you with that sense of loss and tragedy and sadness that's tied to the unrealized dream.
Yeah.
But then also there is that degree of hope that you don't have to be Diane, right? You mm-hmm. can hopefully still find a way to achieve something, do something. The final image of the woman saying silencio is fascinating too, because it does tie back to that whole performance, and what does that performance entail in terms of the artifice of everything? And is it about the artifice of Hollywood? Is it about the artifice of the world that Diane is in? And is it just a cool thing to go back to? Does it have commentary about Hollywood as a whole, Los Angeles as a whole, or is it just putting a final like dropping of the curtain on this story, and that it's just silence now?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Oh, man, you're making me think about the whole scene at the theater when the guy's like, "No hay banda," you know, and he's describing, it's really like an art piece. It must have been some art piece that David Lynch just wanted to do, and he's like, "I'll put it in my movie." But the idea that, like, this guy starts by saying, like, everything you're going to see in here isn't real. Like, it's just a recording. And he does it over and over and over. He's like, "That's not a clarinet. That's not a trumpet. That's not a trombone." And then literally disappears from the screen before the woman comes out and sings the song. And it's just such an incredibly paced scene, because the whole time you're never really questioning if any of this stuff is happening. Like, you know it's a recording because the guy constantly says it. But when this woman comes out and sings, I could see someone ostensibly like forgetting that's the case and just sort of being wrapped up in what she's doing and singing. Just like Rita and Betty are in that moment. Like, they're just crying at like the song she's performing until suddenly you realize she's not really singing it. Like, so much time goes by that maybe you forget. And then all of a sudden the point of everything comes roaring back. It's just such an incredible moment, A, as a viewer to like realize that and like, oh, that's pretty cool. But also just thinking about in terms of what it means for Diane, who's having that dream, and this idea that the dream is trying to like console her, reach out to her, make her realize these sorts of things and like what the metaphor really is. But in the end, it doesn't matter. Like, she's not able to overcome any of it. It's just incredible to rewatch scenes like that and realize like all of that is at stake and like what's actually going to happen in the movie and everything.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles, just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
Yeah, and you have the context of everything, like watching them together in like the joyful moments when you know the ending and everything. It has so much more weight, where you talk about my previous criticisms on the last episode of Hateful Eight. And
I think you brought it up on multiple episodes.
Every episode. Like, knowing it's my go-to example of this style of filmmaking, which is like mildly popular with mysteries. I feel like you either have something like Mulholland Drive, where or Fight Club, where repeat viewings actually just further enhance everything that you watched. Or you have the Hateful Eights or the incredibly loud and extremely closes of the world.
I don't think anybody's talking about that movie anymore besides you.
I hate that movie so much. But you have those that just really misuse mystery. And
I would say Saltburn falls into that camp for me.
I'll have to rewatch it to see. I could see that argument, because I think whenever you're trying to lie to the audience, it's like one thing if a character is lying to themselves, and in that case you can get away with it, which I think is what Mulholland Drive is, which is what Fight Club is. It's like the movie isn't necessarily trying to lie to the audience. It's more that the character, who is the perspective character of the film, is lying to themselves. And that's what makes the repeat viewing so good, because the film was being a bit more objective in how it was handling everything. But then Glass Onion, what's the Knives Out, or Glass Onion and Knives Out Mystery? God, that movie also does the same thing, where it's not the main character lying to themselves. It's that the movie's actively lying to us and thinks it's clever in doing so. And it's always so cheap. I think the only time that it's ever worked for me in the history of cinema, which is an exaggeration, but the only time I can remember off the top of my head right now, was Ocean's 11.
Yeah, right. And which they do in every one of those movies.
Yeah, which they're just like, oh, you think they're caught, but little did you know, they actually did this thing that we just decided to not show you for no reason whatsoever.
It's great, though. Like, the way, like, that movie has fun with the formula in that way.
Yeah, and it's such a small part of it. It's not like the main thrust of the movie is them lying to us the whole time. It's just like, there's just one little small plot, like, part of the whole, like, grand plan that we didn't tell you about. And you're like, okay.
Yeah.
But it's not the bulk of the movie. We lied to you and like tricked you. Wasn't this fascinating? And you're like, no, right. Fuck off.
But see, you're describing why I don't like Saltburn and the way it handles it is like, there can be a beauty to that. Like when we were talking about that movie, I theorized that like, oh, like it's a meta aspect of the movie that, you know, Oliver's lying to us and like testing how we perceive him. But like, I'm also kind of making that up. Like, is there anything in the movie that really suggests that specific of a reading? In the end, it just feels like, no, really, they were just like, there's a bunch of lies and a bunch of things that were kept from me. And any movie in the world can do that and play with that theory. But the difference with Mulholland Drive is like, it's a movie about movies. It's a movie about stories and like the stories we invent. It's such an integral part of the movie that nothing ever, like everything connects. Like the less you know, the more you'll end up understanding about things in a way. Like you don't need to know what's going on for the first 4/5 of the movie to feel the impact of everything. Like once you learn what the twist is, and then upon repeat viewings and everything, like watching Saltburn repeat viewings won't enhance my understanding of this potential theme where like, am I supposed to trust him? Like, no, I get it. And like, that's kind of the end of it, you know?
Yeah. That's, I think my big critique of Saltburn would be like, I did get the shock value on initial viewing of being like, oh, the liar. And we did talk about the meta aspect of like, he's a grifter and we got grifted. And it kind of embodies the fact of how many times do you follow somebody online or like a minor celebrity or something like an influencer or something,
right?
And you think you know them, and then this story comes out about who they really are or how they really are or some behind the scenes thing, and you're just like, oh my god, like I thought I
knew this man.
Yeah, I thought I knew who this person was. I felt bad for them, I empathize with them, and they're actually just like a monstrous grifter. So you do get the form and function of that, but I would like to see a version of Saltburn where everything was like obvious from the beginning. Like we saw mm-hmm. him go about everything that he's doing and the way he was manipulating people. Because I feel like that movie would have more longevity than the version that we got.
Yeah, it would at least give him some humanity to see, like, the way he grew up or what his situation was and why he feels the need to be grifting people. That, I mean, that never even happens once you get the twist reveal.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like, I kind of wanted what you had. Okay.
Yeah. God, we're just talking more about Sulper.
Yeah, I know exactly what you were hoping to do in the Mulholland Drive episode.
Absolutely.
Well, so what's your favorite scene in Mulholland Drive?
Man, I think the scenes that hit me the hardest are ones we've already talked about, which is the theater sequence and then the ending, and how it slowly kind of falls further and further back into the dream sequence ending of Silencio. I just think that's incredible. Why don't you go with any other favorite moments you have while I think about it?
I feel like it's cliche, but Club Silencio is incredible. The last few minutes also get me. I still love the twist of just seeing Naomi Watts and the difference between Betty and Diane.
Yeah.
And the masterclass she puts on and the body language and it's the body language.
It's one of the best performances
so different.
Ever, IMO.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Like 1,000%. And she did not get nominated for any awards, did she?
Oh, yeah. Well, David Lynch movies never get anything.
I know. It's stupid.
I think like the Elephant the Oscars, Man was the only one, really.
The Oscars are pretty dumb.
Yes, they are. When's our Oscars episode, by the way?
Oh, yeah. I guess the next one, do we talk about the nominees?
I was kidding, but we can.
Yeah, seems like a fun thing to do.
It's just going to be me complaining, but sure.
Yeah, it'll be both of us complaining a lot about...
That sounds fun.
...a number of movies. We'll have some positive things to say, I'm sure. But yeah, I think the one that's like maybe not the obvious pick is just Betty's audition scene, which again is just the greatness of Naomi Watts. But it's also one of those scenes where we talk about... On the show, on the website, we talk about micro-narratives and the power of individual scenes that have a beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
And how illuminating, not even illuminating, how just powerful those can be and how dynamic they can be. And there are scenes in this that do that, or moments in this that do that very well. Like the assassin scene is a great micro narrative. The audition scene is a great micro narrative. The
cowboy scene?
Not the cowboy. I don't feel like that's much of a micro narrative.
It kind of is. He learns about it, then goes somewhere, and like, yeah, I guess you're right, though. There's not much more to it than that.
It's more like setup, I guess, something else. I was thinking about the hitman coming to his house and just like walking in and being like, where is he? And then
I like how you consider that a micro narrative.
Yeah, I was trying to think, like, does that have like a beginning, middle, and end?
Well,
well,
the dumpster scene is a good one.
Yeah, the dumpster scene is also a great one of just like, hey, we're having this meeting. And by the way, I had a dream.
Two people you don't know talking about a dream some guy had.
Yeah. Which kind of sets up so much of the movie.
Yeah, totally.
So it's a great use of micro-narratives throughout the film, which I guess ties back to one aspect that we didn't talk about, was that this was originally going to be a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't get aired. It didn't get picked up. That was the thing. And I saw a line that Naomi Watts was just like, great. I'm in the first David Lynch project to never see the light of day.
Yeah.
And Lynch himself, instead of just abandoning it, came back and edited the things that he had into a film. And then they filmed the ending to make it a lot more final, which I didn't see what part was actually filmed as the ending. I don't know if that's all the Diane stuff that we get.
I would imagine.
Or if it was just like the actual like very end with the people chasing her and her shooting herself.
Yeah, I feel like it probably is that. I feel like It would be weird to only film the Betty stuff and then to be like, oh, I got to do this whole other storyline where I'm just Diane. Like, I feel like, I mean, I'm not an actor, so I can't get inside the head of Naomi Watts too much, but knowing the way you are on the other side of the dream can really inform how you act within the dream, you know? Like, there's such a night and day difference between them that I feel like those energies had to have existed ahead of time.
Oh, yeah. She said, like, I'm looking at some of the Wikipedia notes, and it said she found Betty too one-dimensional without the darker portion of the film that was put together afterward.
Oh, wow.
Most of the new scenes were filmed in October 2000.
Yeah. I mean, it's also not surprising to me that the whole movie just, like, originally David Lynch just had it existing in a fantasy, because so much of his movies already do that. Literally almost everyone, like Eraserhead is about this guy dreaming of a life beyond, like, his, you know, working at a factory and having a kid with a woman, this like monster baby that they have together. Blue Velvet's all about the American dream and like how you saw the world and what you thought your life should have been versus like it's the seedy underbelly. Wild at Hearts, somebody, like, these two kids are trying to act like Elvis, you know, like they're trying to live a rock star life, but like, and there literally is a Wicked Witch of the West in the movie. So like Wizard of Oz becomes part of the movie. Like, it's, he just constantly does that. So it's not surprising to me that a whole TV show could have just existed in this fake world, you know, and it could have been really exaggerated and one note in a sense.
Yes. Yeah. I found the interview that she gave with, what was it? Interview magazine. That's appropriate. But they said, how did your character Mulholland Drive evolve between the ABC TV pilots and then the movie version? And Naomi Watts said, in the most brilliant way possible, I saw the pilot and I was really unhappy with it because a lot of Betty was lost. In the beginning, you think she's a one-dimensional character who should be on the side of a cereal box. She's got stars in her eyes, dimples in her cheeks, a bounce in her step. You want to slap her. But the paying off of the character was gone from the pilot. It was sabotaged. And the interviewer says, but then Lynch turned it into a movie with an expanded script. So it seems like there was going to be the payoff. Yeah. It just wasn't in the pilot. And she said, yes, and I got 18 more pages. And the interviewer says, and we saw Betty is actually someone else, Diane. By the same token, the amnesic Rita, who Betty befriends, is also someone else, Camilla. And Naomi Watts says, everyone's got a different interpretation of it, but I had to make something up for myself so I could make some solid, coherent choices. I thought Diane was the real character and that Betty was the person she wanted to be and had dreamed up. Rita's the damsel in distress, and she's in absolute need of Betty, and Betty controls her life as if she were a doll. Rita is Betty's fantasy of who she wants Camilla to be. In the end, though, all the characters are little conduits of David and what's going on in his stream of consciousness.
Totally. That's the answer to every David Lynch movie.
Yeah, 1,000%.
Yeah, and that's one thing I love about him, especially as he gets older and starts to give less of a shit. Like, famously, you know, after he made Eraserhead, which was such a passion project that he spent 6 years making, and all of his own money and, like, the work of basically like a dozen people, you know, like putting together like all of the crazy sets and special effects in that movie. The score was really a laborious process. Like, he put his everything into that. And then to do the Elephant Man and Dune movies, he felt were kind of taken away from him. He really had a grudge against Hollywood and like studios and control, and notably would not compromise anything he did after that. And he just gives less and less of a shit as his career goes on, leading up to Mulholland Drive, which is, you know, while it's, you can ultimately understand it, but it is pretty obtuse in a way. Like, you got to take time to get it and like understand it. And then Inland Empire is just completely incoherent to a lot of people. Although I think I can explain it, go visit the article at filmcolossus.com. but it's that's what I love. I was kind of watching this time, realizing about the beginning, like you were mentioning how there are parts of the first hour and a half that aren't the most compelling. And I almost think there's a couple of different explanations for that, because I know what you mean and agree in a sense that, like, if someone doesn't like Mulholland Drive and can't get into the first part of the movie, like, I kind of get it. There are a lot of really slapsticky moments. And the editing's a little like blockheaded. Like scenes are just kind of stitched together that don't really flow together almost. There'll be like upbeat music in one and then like chilling, like mysterious music in the next. It kind of has a weird rhythm to it, but it's almost done purposely, I think, because it is a movie being put together in someone's head. It's kind of amateur in that way, but also it has like rhythms of 50s shows that Lynch has always been obsessed with. He's always had like this sort of 50s humor in his movie and the way people see like golly and stuff, you know, he always has that kind of stuff. So I view the beginning of the movie as just like that. It's just David Lynch kind of like getting loose with all of the cliches and kind of simpler parts of Hollywood stories. Like you mentioned earlier that a lot of the parts at the beginning of Mulholland Drive feel like they've been copied in other things since. And I think there's a reason for that. Like it's everything's a little simple and plain, like Adam's whole story and like, you know, like the mob people coming after him and like him going home and like the whole, we get a whole scene where he finds his wife cheating on him. And like, again, a lot of like slapsticky, like strange humor. It's just so David Lynch, like all of it. And I just get a kick out of it more and more as I watch that beginning part and like how little of a shit he gives about people like liking it, I guess. Like it's purely done in the style of the movie, and like we're in this woman's head and this is what she's imagining, and it's kind of having fun with it in a way, but also being very serious with it in terms of like its humanistic observations. It's just I don't know, I just grow to love the beginning more and more as I watch this movie.
I can see that. It definitely has the most like, I mean, it is the bulk of the movie.
Yeah.
So diving into it, the tone of it, some of the shots of just like the car going up the hill are so mesmerizing and so cool, because I feel like it made me aware of the fact that you don't see a lot of movies that are just like a lot of darkness, like a lot of natural darkness and just a camera following a car up a hill in just natural like darkness and making the most out of the lighting that you do have. There was something very noirish about it.
It's a neo-noir, so.
Yeah, that was really cool to me. And unlike most of the other shots in the entire film, there was just something very dreamy about it, very color palette-y of like traditional noir when most of the rest of the movie isn't.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I love that. I mean, noir definitely has a huge influence on this movie. Like, in between the scenes where the hitman is, it's a farce and he's accidentally shooting like this woman and goes through this whole day, and or Adam coming home to find his wife cheating on him. Like, in between all that, or all the film noir moments, like everything Betty and Rita are doing is, it's direct film noir plot, basically.
Oh yeah, they're sleuthing. Sleuthing it up.
And like, you know, Diane like toys with becoming a femme fatale, and then you realize like in real life she thinks Camille is the femme fatale figure. It's all film noir stuff.
Yeah. Real life, the proposal and just Naomi Watts breaking down at the dinner.
I actually did
not the proposal, but the announcement.
Yeah. I wondered this time, like I always assumed it was like them announcing their engagement, because I wondered if like maybe they were having a kid or something.
Yeah, it could be either one, but it's at least something that shows like she's committing to him in a major way.
Yes, and the fact that you don't hear what it is, I just love that decision. They're just laughing, like it's such a ridiculous moment. And again, a moment where I could see like someone watching it be like, this is stupid, but I love it.
What a movie. Okay.
Quite a movie. So let's rank this baby.
Yeah.
Chris, are you going to be ranking it? You're not ranking it.
No, I'm categorizing.
That's right.
I'm ranking based on category rather than,
but you're still going to give us a movie sandwich, correct?
Yes. Okay. Still going to give it a movie sandwich.
Okay. So Chris is not going to be ranking them because I think it's driving him nuts to rank hundreds of movies. But I like doing it, so I've ranked mine.
Yeah. So I still have mine like ranked in terms of like what category it falls in. And
which
the
I do as well.
Categories, obviously have like rankings. So favorites, wow, impressive, essentially 10 to 1, right? So I have Mulholland Drive in the impressive category, which is below my favorites and wow. So up there, but I think prior to this watch, I would have put it in the wow section, but I kept it down in impressive for now because in some ways it did feel maybe a little long.
Yeah.
At times. And some scenes that I remember being a little more developed weren't as developed, or some of the plot points I thought were a little more developed weren't as developed. So I ended up like still really appreciating it, but a little like less like gung-ho about it. So it actually fell down just like a tier in the rankings, but it's still in great company, like in terms of the sandwich of things that it falls in. It's joined by movies like Mad God,
okay,
and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem.
That is a juicy sandwich. It actually rose up in my rankings, if that was even thought to be possible. Previously, I had it at number 4. Because I kind of always considered Enter the Void, Showgirls, and Magnolia were like the three that came at very important moments in my life. And they were the kinds of movies that hit immediately, you know? And that's why they've always been at the top. Like, they felt... they just felt momentous in that way, that like, oh, like I remember the moment of my life when I saw this and I remember what it did for me. Whereas Mulholland Drive is like, it's been a constant, like it's been something I've had to slowly learn to love. But this viewing, it transcended that a little bit and became like the ultimate movie in a sense of like, oh, like this is the movie I've lived with the most and spent the most time with and is kind of become part of my life slowly but surely in that way. So I rose it up from number 4 to number 2. So it's now at number 2.
Whoa. So what's the sandwich there?
All right. So on top, we got a nice like multigrain sourdough of Enter the Void. Then Mulholland Drive is like, it's a nice respectable cheddar. And then Showgirls is the turkey, Magnolia is the ham, and then Spirited Away is the bottom layer.
That's a mighty five.
Yeah, it's delicious.
It's a solid sandwich. As a former sandwich artist.
Of course.
It's a solid sandwich.
How many years did you spend as a sandwich artist, by the way?
It was...
or less than a year.
So I started 2004, summer of 2004, I think it was. I don't think it was 2003. I thought I only did it my junior year of high school. And, so it would have been 2003. So like junior year of high school into my like summer heading into college.
Okay.
So like... 03 to the start of 05, year and a half, pretty much.
So about an 18th of your life.
Well, then when I studied abroad in Australia, I worked at Subway for the 3 months I was in Australia. And then when I moved back to Australia, I worked at the same Subway for the first like 3 months that I was back there.
Wow. So we're talking like probably a 14th of your life.
One thirteenth.
Wow, 1/13th of your life. How do you feel about that?
Oh no, wait, 1/18th. I'm not 26 years old. I'm glad it wasn't more. I'm glad it wasn't more.
So this is my follow-up question. If you ever win an Oscar, in your Oscar speech, are you going to thank Subway for your start as an artist?
Yeah, I think I have to, right?
Yeah,
I have to
be just like, making sure.
My artistic journey would not be possible without Subway showing me the way.
Yeah. So just making sure.
Yeah. No. If they want to sponsor the show, I mean, Subway probably won't even exist by the time I'm giving my Oscar speech.
You think so? I think I read somewhere that Subway, were you and I both looking at this? I don't remember, but it was like a list of the most fast food restaurants in the world, and Subway, I think, is number one.
I knew that it was, but they've started closing up a lot of shops.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think the contraction is starting to be real. There was a bunch of stories that came out a couple years ago. John Oliver did one about how Subway was really unfair to its franchisees. And I think Chipotle took a huge part of the market share from Subway of being like the go-to place to eat if you were somebody that was health conscious but wanted to eat something from somewhere quickly.
Right.
So it used to be, you know, you go to the gym and then you go to Subway if you just wanted something quick. Now it's you go to Chipotle.
Yeah.
Chipotle is like healthier, it's more natural ingredients, all of that.
They use real fish.
So Subway, I think, has fallen out of favor in that. And then the prices jumped extraordinarily. Then their menu's also crazy complicated now. And Jersey Mike's also seems to be eating the rest of Subway's lunch.
Chris, I think you could host a Subway podcast.
I think I could. What would I call it? 6 inches or more?
Yes. That's it. Yes. 6 inches or more. Good stuff.
It's a great title. So yeah, I know because they were all over Australia, but them and KFC.
Yeah, KFC's everywhere.
They say, Kentucky, the most popular state in America.
Do you follow on YouTube? Do you follow this guy? I think is it Japan Eats? Do you know this guy?
No.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe you'd be interested in it. He lives in Japan and he'll talk about KFC and the kinds of stuff they have at KFC, and it's hilarious.
I did, when I was in Japan, eat at a Wendy's that was there.
Oh, yeah.
Because it just was so strange to me that there was, like, what would Japanese Wendy's be like?
Look, when I go to Japan someday, I definitely want to eat, like, local cuisine, and I will spend a lot of time doing that. But I do, as somebody who doesn't eat fast food or really like, I don't know if I like any fast food place, I do kind of want to go to fast food places and, like, try one of the weird things they have on the menu that I can't get in America.
Yeah.
Like, I think Wendy's, really want to find out.
Wendy's will satisfy that. Subway, it was like all the same stuff. There was nothing different at Australian Subway than they had.
They're not innovating.
They had like a Raita sauce that I don't think you could get Raita in America. Is that what it is?
Are you making up words?
I might just not be saying it right. It's like an Indian sauce. Raita.
I've never heard of that.
But yeah, they had that as like, you know, one of the sauces that you could put on the sub sandwich.
Okay, then I'll go.
Yeah. So there you go. If that Subway even still exists, if anybody from the Coogee Beach Subway.
Yeah.
Listen to this episode.
Hit up Chris and you'll be the next guest on 6 inches or more.
It's permanently closed. Uh-oh. No.
Well, you could still find one of the employees.
Yeah.
But yeah. I can't go.
Oh, so. Man. The Google reviews are harsh.
for this place that Chris has confirmed is like every other Subway in the world. So
the most horrid customer service I've ever had. The woman behind the counter was terrible. I'm wondering if there are any like Google reviews from when I worked there.
I actually have one specific very fond memory of great customer service that I got at a Subway, because I wasn't a vegetarian at the time, but for whatever reason, for a while at Subway, my go-to sandwich was the veggie sandwich. Just like every vegetable I could get on there with the, it's like a sweet vinaigrette sauce they have. What was it called? And I was just like, that was my go-to. And the woman was like, do you want me to change my gloves? Because she thought maybe I might have been vegan and like the gloves had been touching meat or whatever. And I was like, no, you don't have to do that. And what a lovely thing to ask.
That's nice. Yeah. That's nice.
I don't know why I remember that.
I got a job offer because my customer service there was so good.
Wow.
Yeah, this woman had come in a few times for sandwiches, and she was just like, you're very charming. And I was like, well, thank you. Mm-hmm. You are nice as well. She's like, I work for the Royal Sydney Golf Club. Would you like to interview for a position there?
Wow. Did you do it?
I did.
Did you get it?
I did. And it's the only job I've ever been fired from.
And you went back to Subway?
No, I did not return. I got another job at the University of New South Wales in their study abroad departments. Which was only like a month and a half. And then I got a job at Berkelow Books, a bookstore chain in Australia. But yeah, that job marked the end of my time at Subway. But I only had two shifts. I was working as like a waiter for the golf club course. And being a waiter is so much harder than being a sandwich artist.
She wanted you to interview to be a waiter?
Yeah, I didn't know what it was for. I just showed up and I was like, you know, Monica told me to come for an interview, and they're like, oh yeah, you're gonna be part of the like the wait staff. So my test, I had a test shift where I had to put on a uniform and just go, and it was the lady president of the golf club had a little like group that she would meet with for lunch, and this was the most expensive golf club I think in Australia. So it was where all these like old money people who lived in Sydney went. I think Hugh Jackman was probably like a member of this golf club. It's like that level of like the who's who in Australia. So the president, like the lady president of the golf club, was golfing with her cohorts and was going to come in for lunch afterwards. And me and like a couple other people were part of the service for this. I had to stand at the door for an hour and a half holding a tray of cocktails for whenever the women finished their round of golf. And that was it. I just had to stand there for an hour and a half. I couldn't set the tray down. So at Subway, I was making $18.50 an hour, and this was going to be $26.50 an hour. And then on Saturdays, you got like time and a half. And I think on Sundays, you got double time. So the money could have been like relative to what I like was making pretty insane, like $50 an hour.
Yeah.
But having to stand there for an hour and a half holding a tray of cocktails that they'd occasionally take away from me and replace with a new tray of cocktails because the ice had melted.
Yeah.
Was nonsense. Stupid. And then I had to stand in the corner of the room as the women ate. And I could hear their whole conversation, and it was such like a bitchy, like condescending, like they were just tearing apart. They were talking about membership opportunities and the people who were applying for membership, and they were judging all of the people who were applying for membership and being like, well, they're not good enough. I don't like their kids. Like that kind of,
yeah, right.
That kind of conversation where you're just like, these are horrendous, horrendous people. And then they had these huge chairs, and I was supposed to reach around to grab their plates and put down their food, but the chairs were gigantic, And I'm not tall. I have little T-Rex arms. Mm-hmm. So I'm having to say, excuse me, and they're glaring at me for speaking. So that was my first shift. And then they, I had to work a banquet like two nights later that was like the opening banquet for the golf season or for the golf club for the year. And that was just a nightmare. The head chef was just like holding court in the kitchen. You could tell he was like such a diva, very douchey. He was talking about like the new set of golf clubs he was getting and the new Porsche he was getting, and then yelling at people for all of their food plating and just exactly what you'd expect from a chef, but without any of the charm. Just pure ugh.
See, these and, are the details we get into in 6 inches or more.
Yeah, this is, I should just save it. This was a good tease Subway for that show. I dropped this. I dropped a salt shaker on a man.
That's the most beautiful sentence I've ever heard. I dropped a salt shaker on a man.
Yeah.
Please fit that in one of your novels.
I had the confounding moment of I had to walk around the pre-party with two like pitchers of beer, light and dark. And a guy came up to me and was like, dark beer. And he goes, no head. I want no head. And he meant foam.
Yeah,
you know,
of course.
He wanted no foam on the beer, which, you know, if you're pouring a dark beer, hard to do.
Yeah.
So I had to like tilt the glass almost sideways and pour into it very slowly to limit the amount of foam. And I'm maybe like 10 seconds into this, and he looks at me and goes, can you go any slower? I was like, well, do you want a no foam? Do you want no foam or do you want a quick pour? What do you want? What do you want? What do you want?
Wow.
Give me a tip.
Yeah, get out of there, Chris.
I know. So join us for the rest of tales like this on 6 inches or more.
All right. What's the next movie we're covering?
Oscar season, I guess.
Oh, we're just going to do Oscar season. Okay, so we're going to wait on announcing the movie after that. So we'll do Oscars first.
Yeah.
Okay. I hope that's enjoyable for anybody. I'm just always annoyed at the Oscars. I don't like awards, so that'll be an interesting podcast. Somebody who's disinterested in award season to be talking about the biggest one, but okay.
Yeah, I mean, for the curmudgeons out there, it'll be a show for them.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, let's wrap this up.
All right. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
I need a clear signal that you are ready for this.
I am ready for this.
Okay. Because it's happening.
Okay.
Right now.
Okay. Okay.
And you're not going to get a second try. There's not going to be like more movie after Diane Wick. No, this is it. This is the end. Silencio.
I get it.
Okay. Lights?
Camera?
See ya.
What was that?
See, it's Chris. On my end, we said it the exact same time.
Okay, now I know you're fucking with me because we're not on Skype right now. We're on our phones.
I know, you're right. But I'm still on my internet, so.
What?
Because I am connected to the internet currently.
On your phone?
Yeah, it's working on my phone suddenly. There was a lot of internet issues before the podcast. Okay. We should cut this off.
All right. Silencio, silencio.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.